due to the court's arrest warrant issued for Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister. Analyst and political commentator Mick Napier says the U.S. sanctions against the U.N. rapporteur Francesca Albanese exposes Washington's open hostility toward international law and human rights.
The U.S. has covered up multiple massacres and invasions, overthrowing governments, exterminations, support for the most bestial regimes. And it's covered it up with this veil of commitment to human rights that that they supposedly honour. Now we see them coming out into open banditry. We see them actively promoting the genocide, the Israeli genocide, not as onlookers, but like Britain, as active participants, providing the 2,000-pound bombs and other material which is used in the mass killing, and politically protecting the perpetrators. This is unprecedented, and it's the first time they've actually had to take this kind of disciplinary action against international bodies charged with protecting human rights and preserving the idea of the rule of law. It's very clear that the very notion of international law, of anything that can protect the weak against the strong, has been completely shredded. So the sanctions against this brave rapporteur, I think, simply drive the point home to more and more people.
The Palestinian sources say Israel's refusal to fully withdraw troops from Gaza is holding back progress in indirect talks with the resistance movement Hamas. Sources close to talks say the Israeli delegation presented a withdrawal map that in reality outlines redeployment and repositioning of its forces. They said that Hamas has rejected the plan as it essentially legitimizes the reoccupation of approximately half of Gaza, turning it into isolated zones. They added the Israeli delegation lacks sufficient authority and is stalling talks to prolong the campaign of extermination in Gaza. The latest round of ceasefire talks between both parties began in Qatar Sunday. The talks are facilitated by the Qatari prime minister and senior Egyptian intelligence officials with involvement of U.S. envoy Brett McGurk. Israel continues to violate a ceasefire, with Lebanon launching a fresh drone strike in the south of the country. A Syrian citizen was killed on the outskirts of the town of Al-Khiyam. A ceasefire agreement was negotiated between Israel and the Hezbollah resistance movement last November, following months of intense conflict. Under that agreement, Israel is expected to withdraw all of its forces from southern Lebanon. However, it has so far failed to do so and continues to launch attacks against Lebanon, preventing thousands of residents from returning to their homes in border villages. In the United Kingdom, protesters have gathered outside of Rolls-Royce headquarters in London, accusing the British firm of complicity in the genocide in Gaza by supplying parts for Israel's F-35 fighter jets. The protests are organized by Campaign Against Arms Trade, which says 15% of every Israeli F-35 fighter jet is made by British companies. Our correspondent has spoken to some of the protesters.
Unfortunately, this country is very much complicit as a contributor to the genocide. We've got so many companies producing parts for the weapons, and things like Israeli weapons companies such as Elbit are based in this country. So British companies very much complicit in actually producing the material that is that's being used daily against Palestinians. And it's very, really interesting that we're here. This is Rolls-Royce, are based in this building here. But next door, we have the Guardian newspaper, have their offices, you know, which is an equally important part of Britain's contribution to what's happening, providing the ideological justification. And also, Britain plays a role in hindering and hampering international action being taken against the criminal Israeli government.
Rolls-Royce is one of the big arms suppliers, and you know, they're selling arms in the name of the British people and American people, and I object to killing being done in my name and with my tax dollars.
Yeah, we're here to tell Rolls-Royce to stop arming the Israeli regime. Their engine technologies, both made by Rolls-Royce here but also Rolls-Royce in the US and their German subsidiary, are being used in Israeli tanks, in their armored vehicles, in their warships, in their submarines, in their transport aircraft, in their spy planes, across the Israeli war machine. And we're saying that it's high time that this company stopped supplying those weapons to Israel.
It's just shameful, really, that multiple companies will turn around and support Israel in their genocidal, It's nothing else to say about it. It's just genocide, straight up and simple. We've seen genocide multiple times, and every time we see it, we always say never again, never again. When is it going to be never again?
U.S. Department of Defense has confirmed Iran's strike on its Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar hit a key communications facility. Pentagon spokesperson acknowledged an Iranian ballistic missile destroyed a geodesic dome housing a $15 million communications terminal used by the U.S. military. Structure contains critical satellite equipment vital for maintaining communications between deployed personnel and U.S. military leadership worldwide. Satellite imagery shows the dome intact on the 23rd of June, just hours before the attack, and then completely gone on June 25th. That's right. Came a retaliation for U.S. bombings of three nuclear sites in Iran. The U.S. President Donald Trump claimed Tehran's retaliation was ineffective. Recent Israeli aggression severely impacted three major healthcare facilities in Tehran, including Shahid Mutahedi Burns and Trauma Hospital. Reports indicate significant damage, prompting the medical community to consider filing a legal complaint, as Gisu Misha Ahmadi reports.
The aftermath of the Israeli aggression. At Shahid Mutahedi Hospital in central Tehran, cracked ceilings and shattered windows tell the story of Israeli strikes that damaged vital medical infrastructure. This burns and trauma center, among the busiest in the capital, was evacuated just in time.
It wasn't just one attack. We experienced three or four explosions very close to us, almost next door. The shock waves caused significant damage, prompting us to quickly evacuate as the ceilings were cracking and falling. During the 12 days of aggression in areas close to the hospital, the last attack involved four bombs exploding. You can see how dangerous the shrapnel was. I fought in the Iran-Iraq war, but this shrapnel is unlike anything I have seen before, even on the front lines. The building was shaking. We thought it would collapse at any moment.
As a result, over 100 patients had to be relocated and admitted to other hospitals. The healthcare system here quickly mobilized, forming emergency trauma teams, and doctors and nurses canceled their leaves. Imaging and operating rooms at Mutahedi Hospital remained functional throughout the crisis.
Unfortunately, the shockwaves from the attacks on areas very close to our hospital shattered all the windows and damaged the ceilings and walls. The stress for our patients was immense. Many of them suffered from tachycardia, and those in our ICU who were stable lost their stability. During the attacks, there were operations occurring in the operating room, and it was only the professionalism and rapid response of our healthcare personnel that saved the patients. Fortunately, none of the patients or personnel were injured, but patients had to be relocated to three other healthcare centers.
The resilience of the healthcare workers stands out as a pillar of national endurance, as even under indirect fire, hospitals like Shahid Mutahedi remained on the front line of service. Targeting hospitals and medical centers is a huge red line, and Iranian officials are saying that they will take the matter up with international authorities. Gizum Shahmadi, Tehran.
U.S. State Department's begun laying off over 1,300 employees.
Also, self-sabotage, pulling people back from the front lines when we really need them the most.
And to those that have been riffed, to those that have been fired today, I just want to say I'm sorry. And you have deserved better than this. I think every single person, when you leave this building, you walk through out those doors for the final time, you should do it with honor and dignity. You should not do it out of humiliation and out of this type of weaponization of politics. You deserve better.
We need to do everything we can to stop what's happening right now. And people are standing up like you are right now. and authoritarians and bullies want is they want people to go away. They want them to be quiet. They want them to go quietly into the night. But real patriots, they stand up at moments like this.
Firings will affect over 1,100 civil service and some 246 foreign service officers in Washington, D.C. Move comes just days after Supreme Court cleared the way for the Trump administration to implement its controversial plan to significantly reduce the size of government departments. Critics have sounded the alarm over potential implications of these cuts, in particular as the world faces escalating crises in regions like Ukraine and Gaza. Joining us out of Bali, Indonesia, is Barry Grossman, international lawyer, for more on a story here. Hey, Barry, good to check in with you. Hope you're safe and doing well this morning out there in Bali. It's funny, not too long ago, Barry, there's no safer job on the planet than working for the feds. You basically had to kill somebody at work to get fired, and now things have taken a dramatic shift. Your initial thoughts, please.
Well, I mean, look, I don't feel any great amount of sympathy for these individuals who are being fired. And the larger issue, of course, is purely a matter of domestic concern. There's very little we can say, not being Americans in America. But that said, it's worth observing that these dismissals are not in any way random. In fact, this whole program, which is just beginning, is reminiscent of what Hitler did when he was elected in Germany, as he tightened his grasp on the bureaucracy of government to allow a free rein to his Nazi party to do whatever they want. And certainly if we look at the programs that are being eliminated within the State Department, not that the State Department has any great track record in administering these programs, what's being targeted here are programs to do with migration and immigration, support for democracy, foreign aid, bearing in mind that the State Department absorbed the function of USAID once Trump eliminated USAID. And similar type things. Also, he's targeting energy resources, anything that has that's connected with the sort of the war on global warming, which he doesn't approve of. So overall, what we're seeing here is a move that focuses both policy making and operational control higher up the food chain, focuses with the Secretary of State and the President himself. And I think this move grossly underestimates the complexity of what these various departments do on a day-to-day basis, and overestimates the ability of the political apparatus, namely the Secretary of State and his immediate staff and the President himself, to essentially replace them at an operational level. But this is just another move by Trump to eliminate any and all resistance and to instill a culture of fear.
All right, Barry, great input there. Thanks for joining us. Stay safe, pal. Barry Grossman there joining us from Bali, Indonesia. And this brings us to the end of your news bulletin, everyone. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
The Quran, you notice, it's uniquely styled. It's the only book in the world where God is the exclusive author cover to cover.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Foresight, and I'm your host, Mehdi. Please stay with us. كل شيء ومليك يا رب كل شيء وصانع يا خالق كل شيء وورث. Today's tip: how to strengthen our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude and obedience to Allah via the stories and historical accounts of the Holy Quran. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how we can increase and strengthen and power up our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah via the historical accounts and the stories that we find in the Holy Quran. Now, of course, the first thing that we should keep in mind is that the Holy Quran is the word of the Almighty Allah. It is this perfect revelation that was revealed to the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. It is a book that has been unchanged for over 1,000 years. There are versions or written transcripts of the Holy Quran which date back to the very early years of Islam and the history of Muslims. And of course, we find that even in the present day, the Holy Quran is a holy book that has been unchanged throughout the eras. Now, the stories in the historical accounts that we find in the Holy Quran, they show us the various signs of the Almighty Allah's power and grandeur and majesty. We see the various different qualities and attributes of the Almighty Allah via these stories and historical accounts. And so when we realize and understand and begin to fathom, at least to our capacity, the power and the grandeur and the majesty and the glory and the beautiful, perfect qualities and attributes of the Almighty Allah, then this instills a very pure and powerful form of ubudiyya and worship and servitude and obedience to the Almighty Allah in every single one of us. So, of course, the more you know an individual, the more you begin to love them. And the more perfect that individual is, well, the more you end up loving that individual. And so we will find this true, you know, for most instances. And so it is very similar when it comes to the Almighty Allah. The more we know Allah, the qualities, the attributes, the stories that he has taught us in the Holy Quran, then we will have a deeper understanding of the Almighty Allah, and that will create a deeper and more profound love and admiration and awe of the Almighty Allah. And of course, that results in a very pure, a very sincere, and a very profound form of ubudiyya, a profound form of worship and servitude and obedience to the Almighty Allah, which is based upon knowledge and this realization of the Almighty Allah. IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. Now we invite you to listen to Brother Hassanain Rajabali.
The Holy Quran is the last revelation given unto mankind. The first one actually came with Adam as a commandment from God. And there are four major commandments, meaning revelations that have come from God. There are many, but four major ones. We believe there are at least 313 revelations that came to mankind. And the four major ones is the Torah, which was given to Moses, the Zabur, which was given to David, known as the Psalms of David, the Injil, which the Christians hold today as the Bible, which to us, of course, all these books were actually adulterated and destroyed, so we don't have any original ones. And then the final revelation which came is the Quran, as a covenant of God to confirm what was revealed prior so that to correct the situations of God's law upon mankind. Now, the Quran represents a moral book. It's not a history book. It's not a book of science. It's not a story book. It's a book of morals, because the prerogative for mankind receiving guidance from God is precisely on the moral front, which requires that the human being has to be guided at the moral level. God is not does not send revelations to entertain us or to tell us historically what happened, because that's not the intent of a moral book. The Quran, you notice, it's uniquely styled. It's the only book in the world where God is the exclusive author cover to cover. Every other revealed scripture that is purported to be a revealed scripture today on earth, you will find that human beings are speaking on behalf of God. So if you read the New Testament, you read the Old Testament, these are inspirational books supposedly revealed to people through inspiration, but there is no validity that we can understand from. Whereas we find the Quran, at least systematically, is the only book where God speaks alone. Though the Holy Prophet in Islam, the last Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, is the most important person for us to follow, you find that even he is secondary in the Quran, for he does not speak of his own words, but that which God tells us. And the Quran is a book of morals, and the unique style of the Quran is that it's fragmented when it comes to stories. So you'll find the story of a prophet begins at one point, and then another chapter basically adds on, and another chapter potentially completes it. The only chapter that we know that is a complete story in the Quran, that we categorically can say it's a complete story, is the story of the prophet Yusuf, peace be upon him. As you know, the story of Yusuf starts off where he tells his father of the dream that he had of 11 planets bowing to him, the sun and the moon. And you find that's a complete story. Otherwise, all stories in the Quran are fragmented. But what is fascinating is that the moral objectives are not fragmented. So from cover to cover, the moral objective, the oneness of God, the submission to God, the merciful God, the eschatology in Islam, which implies the belief in the day of judgment, what will happen to the doers of good and evil, what is our objective on life, the lessons that we learn are systematically presented in the Quran without any fragmentations. So that's the Quran. The Quran addresses not only the believers, but also the rejecters of the belief in Islam. And the Quran addresses them all with an equal opportunity to submit to the will of God through very sound arguments that are presented in the Quran. And that's really what it represents for humanity. Muhammad, ya Rasul Allah, ya Habib Allah, ya Khalil Allah, Muhammad.
Welcome back to your listeners. So we are talking about how we can increase and strengthen and level up our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to the Almighty Allah via the historical accounts and the stories that are present in the Word of Allah, the Holy Quran. So, of course, you know, we find all of these various different historical accounts and stories of the past in the Holy Quran. Now, of course, these stories and historical accounts are not just being related for them to be storybooks, right, or stories for us to entertain ourselves. Of course, these stories and these historical accounts in the Holy Quran have a purpose. They have a meaning. They have a lesson. And they are indeed this great divine university which teaches us all of these various different lessons which humanity needs in order to attain salvation and in order to attain prosperity in both this world and the next. So, for example, we have the story of how the Almighty Allah gave a child to Her Eminence Mary, Her Eminence Maryam, without her having a husband, or how the Almighty Allah split the Nile River for Prophet Musa, or how the Almighty Allah drowned Pharaoh, Fir'aun, who was the greatest king or the greatest pharaoh. He was the greatest pharaoh of his era. He was all-powerful, at least in terms of human beings, and the Almighty Allah drowned him in the Nile River. Or, for example, how the Almighty Allah made the previous divine prophets victorious. While these prophets didn't have anything in their hands, they didn't have power, they didn't have wealth, they didn't have weapons or resources, right? And how these various prophets of Allah and messengers of Allah, they rose up against the various superpowers of their respective times, and they overcame those superpowers, something which was, you know, completely unimaginable. Or, for example, the fact that the Almighty Allah created every single human being out of a lifeless clay, and then He gave life, He gave death, He gave honor, He gave izzah, He gave esteem to people, and how humiliation or dhilla is also in the hands of the Almighty Allah. And all of these various different stories and historical accounts and lessons that we learn, it teaches us, as we said, about the Almighty Allah, that increases our admiration, our love, and our awe of the Almighty Allah, and that eventually results in a very powerful and profound form of ubudiyyah, worship and servitude and obedience to Allah. Much for listening to this episode of the program Foresight. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In Iran's proud and glorious history, brave and selfless commanders shine like radiant stars in the sky. Men who, through courage, faith, and knowledge, have always stood as pillars of this land's security and strength. Major General Hossein Salami, the commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps of Iran, was one of the most prominent and influential figures in the history of Iran's sacred defense and the national security. With decades of military experience, a strategic vision, and an approach rooted in authority and innovation, he played a key role in safeguarding the country's security and progress. In the early hours of June 13, 2025, he attained the great honor of martyrdom in a cowardly attack by the Zionist regime on Iranian soil. General Salami was martyred in this treacherous attack, a man who, with his commitment, knowledge, and courage, became a symbol of resistance and steadfastness for the Iranian nation. Hossein Salami completed his primary and secondary education in the city of Gulpaygan, central Iran, and after taking the National University entrance exam, was admitted to Tehran University of Science and Industry in 1978 to study mechanical engineering. His presence in Tehran and at the university coincided with the peak of the Islamic Revolution against the Pahlavi regime, and he joined the ranks of revolutionary student activists. After the revolutionary victory, he briefly worked in popular committees, but with the outbreak of imposed war by Iraq's Ba'ath regime against Iran in September 1980, he joined the defense of the homeland, becoming a member of the IRGC. After the eight-year Iran-Iraq War, Commander Salami pursued professional and academic advancement, enrolling in the Officers' University. Commander Salami was one of the founders of the University of the Command and Staff in the IRGC and served as its commander from its establishment in 1992 until 1995. From 1995 to 2005, he served as a deputy chief of operations of the IRGC Joint Staff, after which he was appointed as the commander of IRGC Aerospace Force, a critical role during which Iran's missile and aerospace capabilities saw significant advancements. Major General Salami possessed multidimensional qualities and exceptional leadership capabilities. He was a distinguished scholar, an alumnus of the prestigious University of Science and Industry in Engineering, and a faculty member at the National Defense University in the Strategic Studies, giving him a high level of academic expertise. He was a memorizer of the Quran and Nahjul Balagha, but more than that, he embodied their teachings. Those who interacted with him closely could attest that this leadership was Quranic and his decisions were often visibly inspired by Quranic logic. As a commander, while he was firm and authoritative, he also maintained a deep emotional and heartfelt connection with all ranks and subordinates. Undoubtedly, Major General Salami was one of the most outstanding commanders of the Islamic Revolution, a man of jihad in scientific, cultural, security, and military fields who stood at the forefront of defending the revolution's ideals with sincerity, wisdom, and loyalty. His patience and ethical leadership made him a commander who inspired calm and confidence in those around him. His unmatched bravery, inherited from the days of jihad and epic resistance, made him a formidable leader who struck fear into the hearts of enemies. Though the martyrdom of this noble commander and his comrades inflicted deep sorrow on the Iranian nation and armed forces, their pure blood has undoubtedly strengthened the towering tree of the Islamic Revolution. It has further solidified the resolve of the great Iranian nation and its revolutionary children to confront global Zionism and its wicked criminal supporters. Just hours after the criminal and terrorist aggression, in the early morning of Friday, June 13th, Iran delivered a decisive and powerful response by launching Operation True Promise 3, dealing a historic and devastating blow to the Zionist enemy. This marks only the beginning of the path of national vengeance, and the Zionist regime must know that the era of unanswered crimes has come to an end. As Iranian renowned scholar Martyr Murtaza Mutahhari once said in describing martyrs, "The martyr's role is not merely to stand against the enemy, to strike or to be struck. If that were all, we would have to say that when he is struck and his blood is spilled, it is wasted. No, the blood of a martyr is never wasted. It does not fall to the ground. Every drop of a martyr's blood transforms into hundreds, thousands of drops, even an ocean of blood, flowing into the veins of society. Thus the Prophet, peace be upon him and his pure progeny, said, no drop is more virtuous in the sight of Allah than a drop of blood spilled in his way. Martyrdom is the injection of blood into the body of society. It is the martyrs who infuse new blood into the veins of society." Welcome back, dear listeners, and thank you for staying with us on Iran Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Tehran, the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Coming up in this hour, we begin with the spotlight. Right after that, we turn to For Humanity, a reflective program that explores key aspects of human life as addressed in the Holy Quran, from personal development to social relationships and family dynamics. This segment offers a Quranic perspective on how to live with purpose and compassion in both private and communal life. Then stay tuned for Africa Today, where we take a comprehensive look at the political, economic, cultural, and business landscape across the African continent. This program provides a valuable overview of developments shaping Africa's present and future. Up next, Spotlight. Stay with us. There is much to explore.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. The Hezbollah leader Sheikh Naim Qassem has said the Lebanese resistance movement will not surrender or lay down its weapons in response to Israeli threats despite mounting pressure to disarm. The Lebanese authorities, under pressure from the Zionist regime and Western governments, most notably the U.S. and France, have called on the resistance group to disarm and lay down its arms. Now, this, as many today attribute the integrity of Lebanon's sovereignty to Hezbollah's arms, its determination and protection of Lebanese soil. It was Hezbollah that put an end to Israel's occupation of Lebanon and kept the country whole for the past few decades. And Sheikh Qassem says, quote, "We will continue to defend because we believe liberation is our duty." This and more of the Sheikh's statements and positions outlined during his speech and interview is what we'll cover in today's Spotlight program. And now for our guests. Joining us, Leila Hatoum, editor-in-chief at MENA Uncensored from Lebanese capital, Beirut. And also, Mr. Mohsen Saleh, the academic and political commentator, also joining us from the Lebanese capital. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we will do the gentlemanly thing and start with you, Ms. Leila Hatoum. Hezbollah argues that Lebanese politicians have opted, Leila, for silence towards repeated aggression by the Zionist regime on Lebanese territory since the infamous late November 27th ceasefire's implementation, including assassinations and occupation. Your initial take on options that Beirut has to defend itself?
Well, you have to understand one thing. When it comes to Lebanon, we have nothing to lose at the moment. And as resistance, basically, so long that you have an occupation, the resistance doesn't have to listen to the dictations of neither the Lebanese government nor the international community. International law gives it the right to move freely in terms of fighting that occupation. At the end of the day, there is mounting pressure on Lebanon, not only by the Americans and the Israelis and basically their allies across the world. I call them the axis of evil. But also from internally, the internal front in Lebanon is divided, severely polarized when it comes to politics and politicians. Some of them, they support the West, and they are funded by the West and the GCC countries, among other Arab nations who are anti-Hezbollah, and somehow like they have animosity against Iran. So at the end of the day, all this basically surmounting pressure that we call tells Hezbollah that they have no allies around in terms of this particular region, and they have to fend for themselves. And that's why basically we saw Sheikh Naim Qassem actually commenting on that matter, saying that so long that there's an aggression, we will not back off from resisting. Nobody can force us to do so, and we will continue to fight, but according to our own time, and we will respond in the manner that we see fit.
Thank you there, Leila. And Mr. Mohsen Saleh, welcome to the program. Sir, now, Mr. Saleh, I'm going to put the same question to Sheikh Qassem. In response to nearly 4,000 ceasefire violations by the occupation since late November, and the occupation of also of five strategic hilltops there in southern Lebanon. So what Israel is not is committed to is implementing the first stage of the agreement, that is withdrawing, stopping its aggression and reconnaissance flights, releasing the prisoners, and starting reconstruction. He said, as much as we are concerned, the equation that America and Israel want to impose, namely either kill or surrender, is not acceptable. What is important to us is our rights. We are ready to be martyred or to win, and we are ready for both choices. Now, Mr. Mohsen Saleh, many people feel this should be the exact position of the Aoun government as well.
Well, good evening to you and to your guests and to the crew and to the audiences. I guess it's about time, as Sheikh Naim, the Secretary General, said, it's about time for people to understand that the resistance attitude from this paper of Brack, Thomas Brack, and the Republic or the Lebanese Republic or the presidents, the three presidents, the Prime Minister and the Speaker and also the President Aoun, I guess they have some kind of asking the same questions of Hezbollah and the resistance. First of all, the Israelis have not been committed to the Resolution 1701. They continued their war against the Lebanese territories and the Lebanese people in the south, on the borders and otherwise, in reaching to Tripoli, killing people, assassinating people, preventing the Lebanese government from spreading or putting its authority in the south. So I guess we are close to the kind of national unity about the issue of the arms. While the Americans and the Westerns, they are threatening the Lebanese government and the people, the Lebanese people, and of course Hezbollah, they are threatening them of the Israeli attack on Lebanon, initiating another war. That's the point, I guess. Now Hezbollah is ready for all the possibilities in terms of confronting and combating on the ground whenever the Israelis want to initiate a war, to also go into the deep borders of Lebanon and also reaching to Syria. That's what they are threatening. I guess it's about time for the international community and the people of the Lebanese government as well to understand that the resistance was not defeated during the talks to arrange the ceasefire. The Israelis were defeated on the ground, in the battlefield. They have shouted and yelled and talked to the Americans, asked them urgently to stop the fire and issue a momentum to stop the fire in the south. That's why the Lebanese government is really trying to understand the resistance position from this situation, while the Americans are always putting the ground for facilitating the way for the Israelis in order to be to have the hegemony in the south and in Lebanon, preparing for the new Middle East, as Netanyahu said, and preparing also for naturalization with Lebanon. This will not happen. The resistance is still ready and more powerful than the past, and the coming days will show that the resistance having all the power that will retaliate against the aggressions of the Israelis. You have mentioned 4,000 attack or violation against the 1701. I would ask the Israelis always, every day they have violation, every day, not only once, all their drones in the skies of Lebanon, all their warplanes in Lebanon, and on the borders they attack even the people who are going back in order to check their homes and their farms, but they are preventing everything. But it's about time to tell the Israelis to stop and the Americans to stop the pressure on the Lebanese, because the Lebanese will not be lenient towards these attacks and these violations.
And good points there, Mr. Osada. Thank you. And Leila, your thoughts on why certain powers are demanding Hezbollah disarm. We have to ask, Leila, why? What is Hezbollah doing, or has it done, to warrant laying down its arms? Because one thing Israel has over the decades, proven is that it is a direct threat to Lebanon, its sovereignty and territorial integrity.
Well, if you look at the whole situation from the Israeli aggression on Lebanon and the second invasion in 1978, because they invaded 1978 first, the presence of multiple resistance groups on the ground were kind of effective in harming a little bit the Israelis, but they were never successful in pushing the Israelis out of most of South Lebanon. The only resistance that managed to actually kick out the Israelis from most of South Lebanon and using strategic weapons and strategic training, and their bases and their basically what you call social milieu is growing year on year, time after time, is Hezbollah. So Hezbollah forms what you call danger to the Israeli plan of having greater Israel, of expanding into South Lebanon and most of Lebanon, if not all of Lebanon, later on to greater Israel, as well as it actually invokes hope in people that there is a possibility if you stand in the face of an aggressor, you can actually beat that aggressor. So at the end of the day, the Israelis are trying to eliminate this glitch in the system. The only way they can do so, they know that they cannot eradicate Hezbollah or the resistance in Lebanon, because resistance is an idea. At the end of the day, what they're trying to do is weaken Hezbollah to the extent that they are going to try to disarm it from its strategic weapons and create a toothless tiger out of it. And this is impossible to happen, knowing the Lebanese and knowing their mentality and knowing how they basically stick to their land and they fight back. They are some of the strongest fighters in the region. So because they pose threat to the Israeli entity and its plan for the region to have greater Israel, and the European and Western plan in general to continue to have this parasitic entity among us and subdue and subjugate the rest of the populations in our region, that's the reason why they're going after Hezbollah and the resistance in Lebanon.
Interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. And Mr. Saleh, also elsewhere in Sheikh Qasem's remarks, he roundly rejected for the movement to lay down its arms. He said there is no third option between victory and martyrdom. We do not have surrender as an option. So Hezbollah's position, it is and it has been simple, cut and dry. How do you see things playing out? Hezbollah maintains this position. Moving forward, the pressure persists from the U.S. and its allies and the Zionist entity. Where does it end, or do we reach an impasse, or how do you see this thing unfolding in the future?
Well, in the manner of the Israeli natural instinct towards Lebanon and towards the Palestinians and towards all the Arabs and even the human beings, in confronting such instincts, I guess the resistance in Lebanon, they have no choice, no option but to continue in struggling against these criminals who committed all the crimes in the modern history in Gaza and in Lebanon and anywhere in the places wherever they go, to Yemen, to Iran, of course. What would you do but to tackle and grip your hand on the arms you have and the courage you have and the belief of not only victory, but you have to defend by blood and by the arms. It's these real things, as I said in the beginning, that the resistance was not defeated on the ground. They have implanted their bodies and their blood in on the borders and prevented the Israelis from going into the Lebanese villages and cities in Khiyam and Naqoura and Ayd al-Shaab and other places. So I would say Sheikh Naim, the Secretary General, is reaching the point that the resistance, the freedom fighters in the South, they are saying that they are ready to continue the battle against this enemy who will not stop but by the resistance. The resistance, the only way, the only path in order to stop this enemy from putting an end to its aggression. And the Americans and the Lebanese government, they understand that. That's why Barak said he won't guarantee any Israeli aggression. He knows, and the Europeans know that they cannot stop the Israelis. The only thing that might stop the Israelis is the resistance. That's why Sheikh Naim said either martyrdom or victory. There is no other choice. As you said, brother, is there any other choice, any other option in confronting the Israelis? The problem is that either they have the hegemony and the upper hand and to enslave others, or to kill them. That's what they have been doing in Gaza and the West Bank. That's what they want to do in Lebanon. But the issue is that the resistance in Lebanon is powerful, strong, and believe in its right in defending its place. The might does not make right. The Israelis have no right in order to invade or to kill or to occupy any parts of Lebanon. That's why the Lebanese government has only one choice, but to come to unity with the resistance in order to protect the sovereignty and the authority. If the government insists on having the monopoly over everything in Lebanon, under the pressure of the American and the French and the Europeans, I guess we are going to a deadlock and not having a solution. That's what the Israelis want. But I would say firmly, with great confidence, that the Israelis cannot go into Lebanon and invade Lebanon, because the resistance is still powerful and have all